A cold one masks the abstract. Step back and feel the contrast. Echoes of a broken past. Before my eyes the future flashed. Concepts the moment past. Fear of the manifest. Waging battle on my spirit. Surrender to what's fearless. See what bodies mix of love and lust. When love was hard to touch, I toss a prayer your way. Namaste, baby, namaste. Namaste, namaste.
Welcome to Yoga Talk, the Yoga International podcast. That was The Householders with our intro, Namaste Nation. I'm your host, Kat Hegberg. I'm the editor of yogainternational.com.
And I'm Michael Carlucci, one of the content folks at yogainternational.com.
And today, Michael and I are talking about a subject that we've had some listener requests about. And it's a subject that I, as a yoga teacher, and I think you, Michael, as a yoga teacher, are just really interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And that topic is how to teach teachers.
How do you teach teachers?
Like how to teach a workshop for teachers, or perhaps you're interested in offering a 200-hour teacher training of your own. How would you go about doing that?
Yeah, what would you do?
And, well, we're going to find out today mm-hmm. because we're joined by one of our teachers.
One of our dear teachers.
Sherry Friedrichsen. Hi, Sherry.
Hi, Kat. Hi, Michael.
And Sherry, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, or our listeners a little bit about yourself, and what it is you do with the Himalayan Institute and their teacher training program?
Okay. I've been teaching for 38 years. I've been studying yoga for about 40, and I joined the Himalayan Institute teaching program in 1999. I started coming here to work with the teachers. I've been working with the teachers all over the U.S. and Europe. I started in the 80s, so I have a lot of experience teaching teachers. And what I'm excited about now is I want to teach other people how to do what I do.
I want to learn how to do what you do.
Yeah.
So great. I'm excited about that, too. I think we both are.
I want to do it in costumes from the 80s, you know, like almost, you know, like fabrics from polyesters and stuff
with
like that.
With the leotards and the tights.
Totally.
Leotards
like
over the tights,
that's
too.
That's right.
Yeah.
With
yeah.
some really, like,
totally.
Like, overly rich, you know, like flamboyant music playing.
Leg yeah. warmers.
Jane Fonda on the TV, yeah. something like that.
That's about it.
Uh-huh.
That's the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
The 80s, listeners. So, Sherry, we have a couple of questions for you that we're hoping you can shed some light on about, no matter what decade we're in, how to teach teachers. And the first thing I'm curious about is what are maybe some of the prerequisites or preparatory steps that someone should think about before maybe they just jump in and start their own teacher training? Should they offer some smaller trainings or workshops first? Is there anything they can do to prepare, maybe assist other teachers? What would you suggest?
Should they fast? Should they do Surya Bedi? Should they do like a long mala of some kind of special mantra? Should they ride a dragon
that
or a unicorn?
Could help too.
That would be good.
Sure.
Okay, probably the first thing that they want to do is really be established in their own practice. Mm-hmm. And because all the teaching comes from your own practice. 75% of whatever you teach should come from your own practice. So that's the first thing. Second thing is, yes, attend seminars like crazy. Go to everything that you can imagine. You know, you see something on headstands or backbends or prenatal yoga or anything. Go. Just go. And become a sponge for yoga. And then also, if you have a favorite teacher, ask that teacher if you can assist, especially in seminars or large workshops where you can have a vast amount of bodies to look at to see, wow, look at how that person does Trikonasana. Look at that person over there. Their shoulders are jammed up. So that you can begin to see lots of different styles, you can begin to see lots of different bodies, and lots of different approaches to yoga. And then study. How do the Yoga Sutras, how do they weave themselves into modern-day asana practice?
Hmm.
You know, and so find a philosophy that you can work with, either the Bhagavad Gita or the Yoga Sutras, something that you love that's going to enliven and embrace your practice. And then start teaching seminars yourself. And you might want to, say, teach a seminar on backbends. And then, you know, a month or 2 months later, gather teachers and say, okay, I want to teach you how to teach backbends. And start with the one thing that you love that's simple. But it always has to come from your heart. It always has to come from what you love.
You love, yeah.
Yeah. And that's so really, I really like what you said, too, about incorporating, like, the Yoga Sutra and the Bhagavad Gita into the practice and into the teachings. Because I know in every, like, 200-hour training I've ever taken or assisted, those have been the two texts that we've studied. And there's also been a lot of questions around that. Like, why is this relevant? Like, why are we studying this?
Yeah.
So that would be, I think that would be really useful.
Yeah. How do you take a text that's over 2,000 years old and weave it into what I'm facing today? I have a stressful job. I'm on the freeway for an hour every day. What does that have to do with anything? You know, those ancient yogis didn't understand a bit about modern society. I mean, that's our belief. And
right,
as we
right.
dive into the Yoga Sutras, we see, oh, they wanted the same things I do. They wanted joy. They wanted fulfillment. They wanted freedom from sorrow and suffering. Mm. It's the same exact thing that I'm dealing with. And so if you can weave that into an asana class, a pranayama class, a meditation class, then those ancient teachings become valuable today.
Sounds great. Sounds like a great way to, like, transpose the ancient teachings into our modern day.
Yeah, we're all looking for the same thing.
Yeah, we all want the same thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Joy, freedom, fulfillment.
Simplicity.
Yeah. Simple needs met. You know, I want to feel better about my life. I mean, 2,000 years ago, don't you think they were wanting the same thing?
Probably people want to feel better about their lives.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go out on a limb and say it.
Well, and as a teacher, I think I love, like, having that intention there, because so often it's so easy, like, especially, like, if you're teaching, you know, teachers how to teach, to get so, not that the anatomy and physiology isn't important, but to get maybe so caught up in the alignment that then we're trying to fix everybody all the time.
Yeah.
Or, and we lose the purpose behind it, the idea that I feel like ultimately as a yoga teacher, or a little bit of experience teaching teachers, not a ton, but that I want to remember that my main focus is about uplifting people and helping people to feel better, not making them feel worse because they can't touch the floor in triangle or something.
Yeah, exactly. Or at the same time, if somebody hasn't studied anatomy and physiology, you know, they might freak out and be kind of overwhelmed by the names of the muscles or the joints or how things are connected. And Kat knows that I call this alignment bypass.
So. Michael does not like, despite the fact that he knows a lot about anatomy and physiology, our listeners know he does not like to talk about it.
Well, yeah, well, it's like what Gary Krafsow told us on that last interview we did out in San Francisco. It's like, what's more important, your hamstring or your liver?
And physiology versus anatomy.
Yeah,
sure.
But then I would go one step further. What's more important, your iliosacral joint or your jyotishmati? You know, this is what I'm going.
And then you have to find out how your iliosacral joint can lead you to jyotishmati. That's the cue. That's the thing. If you bring all of yoga together, then every little piece of your anatomy, every little piece of your physiology can take you to that point of light, can take you to that point of freedom from sorrow.
Right on.
So
this is why we study with Sherry.
Yep. Right? Exactly. So the next thing I'm curious about, Sherry, is how would you say that teaching teachers specifically differs from teaching the general population?
Oh, my gosh. It's a world of difference. Okay, so to teach the general population, you have them in front of you. You teach them, you know, step your feet here, do this, raise your arm, breathe. Don't forget to breathe. You know, breathe into your abdomen. And then you get them out of the pose, and hopefully you haven't hurt them in the process. Teaching teachers come in with such varied backgrounds and levels of confidence. You have to get, and the thing is, most of the teachers that take a teacher training do so because they love their teacher. And their teacher makes teaching yoga seem easy. They do it really seamlessly, without any jolts or surprises. And then they come in and they're an empty slate. They don't know how to tell someone to spread their feet 3 feet apart or one leg length, and or what comes next, how to get people into the pose or out of the pose seamlessly like their teacher could. So it's really taking the alphabet that they've learned and getting it getting them to put it together in words, so they can say what you've said all your life, you know, or what you're so familiar with. They have to have a language for that.
Sure.
So the thing that makes this teacher training so great is we have a systematic approach to teaching that allows you bring in these people that don't know how to say, step your feet 3 feet apart, raise your right arm, and we give them simple little steps to do it and give them a way that they're free to make mistakes. And then they learn from each other. So teaching teachers how to teach is much more difficult, and you have to work with the person in front of you, see where they are, see what their language is, and then you have to build their confidence that they can do it. And that's another whole process. You know, how much yoga do they know? What are they familiar with? And how do you start with where they are and build their confidence to teach what they know? Not what you know, but what they know.
Yeah, and I like what you were saying, too, about just, like, the actual opportunities to teach. Because I do feel like that's when I, like, you know, talk to people about their 200-hour teacher trainings. A lot of people I know have taken multiple 200-hour teacher trainings, myself included, and we sometimes joke about that together. And one thing that we always come back to is, like, in the beginning, I didn't really get to teach. Like, you might learn a lot about yoga, but you don't always necessarily get a chance to teach. Mm-hmm. And when you're actually going to teach your class, that's what's really, I think, going to be most valuable.
Yeah, well, this is one of those things where it's like you can know all of the technical information and even all the theoretical information, but it's like, Kat, you and I have talked about this a lot, and how, like, people are so afraid of public speaking, even more so than death. And it's like, I like getting in front of people and making a fool of myself. I used to be an actor and a performing artist and stuff, but I notice sometimes with people, there's a challenge to just basically open their mouth and let the information come through.
Right.
And this, to me, is sort of like goes back to what Sherry was saying about your own practice, because if you're so confident and seated and steady in your own practice, then essentially if you can have some trust that the words will come, then the words will probably come in a way that actually is skillful for the students. So to me, it's almost about developing public speaking skills even more so than the theoretical stuff.
Yeah. You have to have that practice, and then you have to be able to speak about it. And it's the public speaking skills, and that's what we give. We do not let 24 hours go by without them teaching, without the student coming in and teaching. And we make it gradient. It's like teach one person. Teach one person how to do one pose. Mm. And then we build on that. We have 20 days, or you have, if you do it in weekends, you have all these weekends where every weekend or every day you begin to build, teach one person, and then they teach one person for 4 days, maybe four different poses. And then after that, they teach two people. And they teach another set of poses to two people for another few days. And then it just gradiently. So by the end, they get up and they're able to teach 20 people a series of poses. And it's remarkable to see the joy on their faces, the confidence that they've built, and the fact that they couldn't speak. They were like choked at the beginning. And now they're completely confident. They know how to get into a pose, out of a pose, what the experience of the pose is, what the philosophy behind the pose is, how to breathe in the pose, how to activate the internal fire of that pose, how to activate the internal awareness of that pose. It's so rich.
I'll never forget Sherry, Greg, and Rolf, my great teachers in the 200-hour, pulling me out of bed at 3:30 a.m. and making me teach Trikonasa, Ardha Matsyendrasana, and a pranayama technique to an entire class by candlelight. I'll never forget that.
Wow.
Listener, that didn't actually happen.
Maybe Greg and Rolf, but I wasn't there.
I could see 6:30 a.m., but I'm 3:30. That's pretty early. Yeah.
No, we do it gradiently so that there's the fear is faced gradiently. And so that once you overcome a little bit, then you get stretched a little bit more. Just like moving from Trikonasana to Parvrita Parsvakonasana. There's a gradient way to do that. And there's a gradient way to begin to teach. And that's what we use, that systematic, scientifically proven gradient way to build someone's confidence, to build their knowledge base, and to give them their own voice. So they're not using my voice, they're not using your voice or your voice, they're using their own voice. And I think that's one of the errors that many people that are studying yoga make, is they think they have to have their teacher's voice. Mm-hmm. And they throw away themselves. Yeah. And that is such a loss. That is such a loss of that person. Mm. We want to develop that person, develop their personality, develop their confidence. Go teach your own way. Go teach your own style.
What is the thing the Bhagavad Gita says, that it's better to live your own dharma badly than someone else's dharma well?
Yes.
Is that true? Did I get that right?
Chapter 18, verse 46 and 47.
Wow.
Awesome.
Yes. Live your own dharma. On every dharmic path has mistakes, but yours will be your mistakes, and you can learn from those. If you follow someone else's path, you won't learn, and you'll have lost yourself in the process. Mm. So thank you, Michael.
I feel like we should ring a Zen bell or something like that, because it's like, listener, you're done. I mean, you can walk off into the sunset now and, like, pull an apple from a tree.
Only don't, because I have another question
because
for Sherry.
There's more.
So I'm curious, Sherry, often 200-hour teacher trainings are filled with participants from diverse yoga backgrounds and of diverse skill and experience levels. Like, you might have a lot of people who are teaching already, and you might have some people who maybe just started practicing and want to delve in a little bit deeper. As the teacher trainer, how can you gauge where everyone is at in that group and kind of reach them on their levels when these backgrounds are so diverse?
I have to admit that this is the most fun I have, is when the backgrounds are so diverse. Mm. Because you can, as a skilled teacher, you can address everyone exactly where they are. So you get someone that comes in and their background is, they've studied with Bhatavi Joyce, they know Ashtanga yoga, but maybe they now want to start teaching and they can't find an Ashtanga teacher in their area or that works for them, so they come here. And then you get someone that has taken like an eclectic approach to yoga, and they haven't really done that much study, but they've been practicing for a couple of years and they'd like to teach. So you get them in the same room. Basically, the way we approach teaching yoga is going to be helpful for both of them. The first thing is, we have a systematic approach that's based on breath awareness, alignment, and the foundational texts of yoga. Once those are interwoven to the teaching, the Ashtanga person can find, this is what happens in triangle pose as you move into this pose, as you move into this pose. Each pose has its own unique benefit, background, purpose, tie to yoga. And at the same time, the absolute beginner can see, this isn't as hard as I thought. It's a very systematic approach. You do this, you do this, you do this. And then the Ashtanga teacher has all this information now about so much more than the flow, than the series, that they can interweave to their class and feel totally confident that what they're doing is enhanced by their training. So they've done series, the different series in Ashtanga, and now they know how to break it apart, why you would break it apart. If someone's injured, how would you work with that? If someone's slow to pick up movement, how you work with that? And then the absolute beginner goes, this is how you move from one pose to another pose. You can come out, or you can just go directly into it. But I think the real thing is just for anyone that's coming to teach is how to make sense. And that's what appealed to me about this tradition, is how do I make scientific sense out of what I'm doing in a pose? What does it matter? Who cares? This is what I came to when I had been doing yoga about 15 years and I was teaching in Europe. And I came to the point where it was like, this doesn't make any sense to me. I have to go back and dive in and study the foundation of yoga to see, why am I doing triangle pose? Why am I doing warrior pose? You know, I mean, I can do it.
Yeah.
I've trained my body to do it, but it doesn't make sense to me. So to go back and find the foundation, and I think that's where our training addresses everybody's questions, from the very beginner to the very advanced yogi. I know when we teach a 500-hour training here or a 200-hour training, I go to as many of those classes as I can, whether I'm teaching it or not, because every single time I'm learning.
Yeah.
I'm really learning. And I love that. I love that about our training, and I love when we have different people. My own personal background was Iyengar. I love Iyengar yoga, but I'm also completely fascinated with vinyasa, with Ashtanga, with Bikrams, with hot yoga. I went to, when I was in L.A. Many years ago, I went to a Kess power yoga class.
Brian Kess
power yoga class. And it was so challenging, and I loved it.
Yeah.
It's just, I have never sweated so much in my life. And at the end,
I love it, dude.
Yeah, I just, it was like,
I was just imagining Sherry walking out like a raisin. I don't know.
Yeah,
it was, a bit.
You know, I had never done that type of yoga before, but a friend of mine had said, oh, you have to come. And he was a friend of Brian's. And afterwards, the teacher, Brian, approached me and said, where have you studied yoga? And because it didn't matter what style.
Right.
It was the essence of yoga coming through.
Yeah.
And he obviously saw, you know, that there was, that I was new to his class, and I didn't know the flow that he was doing, but I followed along really well. But he liked my poses, and I loved his class. It was just so challenging and so lovely, and I was just wet from all my clothes were soaked through. My mat was useless. It was completely wet.
Oh, and, yeah. There's those hot power yoga classes where my parents live, and every time I go to visit them, I get, like, the pass, and I go every day. And it took me, like, about a month to realize I need a towel on one of those
mats. I didn't realize that either, Kat.
Yeah.
It was like everyone had towels, and I thought, well, that's kind of weird.
Yeah.
Until about 5 minutes into the class.
That's
oh,
why.
Oh, my God, where's my towel? But having someone come like that to our training that's been doing power yoga, it's such a joy for me because then I can explain, oh, yeah, this pose has this as a foundation. This is where you want to breathe. And then you can take that into what you're doing, and it brings the life out of out of the practice. It brings it right to you, the life. It awakens in you something more than just going through the series.
Yeah.
So that's what I love about teaching lots of different styles, how to teach teachers.
Yeah, and how, like, I guess it sounds like you can find a lot of common ground even when the styles seem like they're very different
totally
from each other.
Totally different, because Kat, you know me. Do I look like a power yoga, hot power yoga person? And Michael, no, I don't, but I loved that class. And I also had a really dear friend that was an Ashtanga teacher. And we would work, I would stay with her when I went to L.A. to teach. And she would come to my classes, and then privately she would teach me Ashtanga. And I loved it. I loved the movement. I loved the grace. I loved it. And how to incorporate that in the teacher training, that wisdom of yoga that can come through no matter what you're doing, and then gather it, sink it into your being, and then you take it everywhere and anywhere, to any class that you want to go to any style that you want to teach, and be better at it. Because that's really what the Yoga Sutras teach. Practice kindness, practice compassion, practice strength, practice faith, and then go live your life. So I would say the same things, and then go do your practice. Then go do your asana practice with the foundation of all these great teachings of yoga that say, you know, practice kindness towards those that are happy. Mm. Practice compassion towards those that are sad or broken or suffering. Practice joy when there's virtue, when you find virtue in yourself or in others. Practice equanimity when you've found that there's a non-virtuous action taking place. Practice equanimity.
Yoga Sutra 133.
Yes. Like
had to get that in.
For our Buddhist friends are the four immeasurables, that's if you're right. interested.
Yes. Yeah.
So, and all those teachings, all the Yoga Sutras are all based on the ancient teachings. So, of course, they draw from Buddhism, you know, and it's all woven together.
It's just like the different styles of yoga in a way.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. The bottom line is they're the same. Hmm. And then we take it, you know, one becomes a blue butterfly, one becomes a pink butterfly, one becomes... Oh.
Now you're talking my language here.
I know, Michael.
Little dots. One's a pink butterfly being ridden by a fairy.
So I want to talk just a little bit specifically about 200-hour teacher trainings. And if we have any listeners who might be interested in perhaps eventually offering their own 200-hour teacher training, how they could maybe go about doing that. And I mean, of course, there's different routes you could take. You might choose to align with Yoga Alliance, or that might not be something that you want to do. If you are interested in offering a yoga teacher training that is affiliated, or meaning that if you want to be a registered school with Yoga Alliance, meaning that your students who graduate from your 200-hour teacher training can then register with Yoga Alliance as RYT 200s, then there are some prerequisites for that, and you can find out that information at Yoga Alliance's website. The most basic information to know, though, is if you want to teach a 200-hour teacher training as a registered yoga school, you do have to be an ERYT 200 or above, which means you've completed a 200-hour teacher training and you've logged over 1,000 hours with Yoga Alliance, and that 1,000 hours has been 2 years since, or logged in the 2 years since you first registered as a yoga teacher. So that's the most basic requirement. There are more requirements if you want to teach, say, a 500-hour training. And I know, Sherry, you said that if our listeners perhaps had any other questions about how to work with Yoga Alliance, that Judy Moulton at the Himalayan Institute would be a good person to contact.
Yes. She's the one that has all the info.
Yes. And where can they reach her? Her email is?
Her email is jmoulton, J-M-O-U-L-T-O-N, at HimalayanInstitute.org.
So she would be a great person to talk to. She has lots of information about that. But whether you're interested in offering a 200-hour training as a registered yoga school or not, which is certainly an option, there's actually a really cool training that Sherry is doing with our teacher, Rolf Sovic, as well, who unfortunately couldn't be here recording today, but we'll get him in here sometime soon. And I love it if you could tell us a little bit about that training, Sherry, because I think our listeners would be interested.
Okay, what we are doing, and this is new, and we're totally thrilled about it. We already have registration going on, and what it is, secretly, quietly call it the 5 T's, teaching teachers how to teach a teacher training. but I think we're not going to call it that publicly. We're going to call it Mastering the Art of Training Teachers. So what we are wanting to do, and we've set up a seminar to do this, is we want to teach you how to teach the best teacher training that you can offer your studio. And this is for people who have never taught a teacher training before, but as you said, are ERYT certified, or people who have already been teaching trainings, but they want more depth to it. They want more foundation to it. And also what we offer, so we offer that. It's a 5-day training. We offer depth. We offer foundation. We go from A to Z. But we also give them our manual, which is packed.
It's really good.
It's really, really, really good. It's got a ton of stuff in it.
It's just packed full of information. I still look through it and find things that I haven't seen before. And I'm like amazed, like, where did this come from?
Gandalf.
And if not Gandalf, at least Patanjali.
Yeah.
So, and it has all the foundational texts, the jewels of what we do. It has all the treasures of what we do packed into one manual. So that alone, I think, is worth the price of the training. And then we offer, we teach you how to teach what we do. So Rolf will teach how to teach what he does, which is an amazing, if you...
I want to learn how to be a Rolf.
Yeah. I think all of us would like that.
It would be like 4 hours of meditation a day, probably, is a place to start.
And then I think the really rich thing about this training and what we do best is how to gather these ancient teachings that Rolf is so adept at and so skilled in and so knowledgeable about, and how to weave them into pranayama practice, asana practice, meditation practice. And then how do you teach someone else how to do that so that you're teaching teachers from your studio? You're not teaching classes anymore, but you're actually teaching teachers. And I think that will enrich your studio, it'll enrich your life, and it'll enrich the world. And one of the things why we're doing this is because our chief executive officer, I think he's called now, Ishan, has decided that it's time that the wisdom go forward, that we've been teaching it here for a long time, and now we want to give the wisdom that is part of our tradition away. We want to give it to the world. We want it to spread. We want to pay it forward so that it's not kept in these mountains anymore, these beautiful mountains here in Honesdale, but really spread out to the world, because the world right now is suffering. The world is in pain. And through these teachings, we can help alleviate the suffering in the world. And I think that's really the goal of our, just give it away. Teach people how to do what we do. Get every studio to really go to the ancient texts, couple it with modern science. And that's what we do, how teaching has changed over the years, is that we, and what we do here, we have to keep up with modern science. We have to know, what's a heart attack? Where does it come from? How does yoga help? How does yoga help with diabetes? How does yoga help with dementia, with Alzheimer's, with all these modern problems that we seem to have? How does teaching yoga help begin to alleviate the modern suffering that we have today?
Yeah.
How does it help with PTSD? We have all these soldiers coming home with these intense sorrows and pains. How does yoga help with that? And so we have to stay at the cutting edge. And I think here at the Himalayan Institute, we've been at that cutting edge for thousands of years. How do we weave this into modern day? How do we weave this into modern day? And we're still doing that. And I think that everybody should come. Whether you've taught trainees before or not, you will learn. And we will all be more joyful.
Excellent. And when does this training take place, Sherry?
This training takes place. It starts the Wednesday after Halloween. We all know Halloween. That's a good date to start.
Yeah, we all know Halloween.
Right. When we're closest to the spirits. And it starts Wednesday, November 4th, goes through Sunday, November 7th. So it's a really solidly packed few days.
Excellent. And we will link in the show notes, listeners, to how you can sign up for the training and who to contact if you'd like even more information about it. Well, thank you so much, Sherry, for talking with us today. I learned a lot. I feel really inspired. I hope our listeners did too. And listeners, if you have any additional questions about teaching teachers, about today's episode, or any of our episodes, any show ideas, comments, questions for Sherry or for Michael or for me, you can send those to yogatalk@yogainternational.com. And we have a couple of listener mails or pieces of listener mail to read to you today. And these couple are actually from our recent episode on the pornification of yoga, which I was surprised that we got so much feedback from that. I got some really great feedback from you guys, not only via listener mail, but in the comments on the podcast, and some people just who have emailed me privately and talked to me. So I know when we recorded that one afterward, I said to Michael, did I sound like really angry or fired up? Maybe we shouldn't publish this one. Yeah. And I'm really glad that we did, because we got some really good conversation going. So this first letter comes from Faith, listener Faith. And she says, the yoga pornification articles, which referring to the articles in the show notes, were interesting. I love that word, pornification. It says so much. We need to go back to the real purpose of yoga, to prepare the body and mind to sit in meditation. Actually, this is how I learned what the ultimate purpose of yoga is. Back in the 1970s, after doing a series of yoga stretches and while breathing into them, followed by relaxing into a 15 to 20 minute shavasana, I began to have what I called the heaven or God experience. And back at that time, I was agnostic. They were the kind of experiences from which one does not want to come back. I had grown up in a strict fundamentalist religion in which the body was considered evil, a source of temptation and sin. Through the above experience, I learned a new and wonderful perspective on the body. It, the body, is the most wonderful instrument for helping a person evolve through meditation. A couple of years ago, a 20-year-old young man told me that he had been raised as an atheist. In his high school gym class, the students did a yoga series. Just as it happened to me, he experienced going to another wonderful level of his existence during the relaxation at the end of each class. He told me that he had found, quote, God. In any yoga classes to which I have gone in recent years, the shavasana relaxation at the end of class is 5 minutes or less. This is not enough time. One needs to relax for a longer period to gain the, quote, God experience. Thank you, Faith, for offering your perspective and for listening to the episode. I'm really glad that resonated with you in that way. And that was really interesting, hearing about your experiences, and really inspiring, too. So I'm glad that you have that to share with your students. Very fortunate. And then we have one more letter today on that same episode. And this one comes from listener Brantley. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. If not, please write in and let me know. And Brantley says, "Hello, today I listened to this podcast on yoga pornification. I was actually surprised to not hear you mention the Catherine Buttigieg toe socks ads where she poses naked, albeit for a pair of socks. I had read an article by her where she said she did those ads in her 20s and now she's in her 30s and she feels differently about having done them. I think more specifically, she recognizes that her body from her 20s is not the same body she has now in her 30s. She's also becoming a big advocate of body image in yoga, so it would be interesting if you were able to obtain her perspective on this topic. I remember reading a letter to the editor in Yoga Journal specifically about Catherine's toe socks ads. It came from a prison inmate who subscribed to the magazine and said that he and his fellow inmates looked forward to viewing the ads on a monthly basis. I was disappointed that Yoga Journal would even honor that letter to the editor and publish it in their magazine. What a joke. Regarding the part of the podcast in which the gentleman..." That's you, Michael. You're the gentleman.
Oh, I'm not the gentleman. I'm not yes. A gentle listener. But...
Oh, I don't know about that. "In which the gentleman talks about maturity. I don't know if pornification is such an issue related to maturity as it is to taste. However, if you think about a new yoga practitioner, they tend to come to yoga for physical reasons, to feel better, to look better. And after a while, perhaps as their practice begins to mature and deepen, a shift will occur and the practice becomes more spiritual. That person wants to take better care of herself by eating better and acting better toward herself and others. I believe that's definitely due to a deepening in maturity. Some of those pictures of body image, regardless of what they are, could be enticing to get a person to come to their mat just as much as it could be to chase them away from a class. That part, I believe, is personal taste. So definitely some things to ponder. Thanks for raising the topic. Namaste, Brantley." Well, thank you, Brantley, for writing in with such great questions and offering your perspective as well. You make a really good point about the toe socks ad. That would have been a really good thing to address on the podcast. I think the main reason why we didn't is because in our first episode on yoga and body image, episode 1, which you can find on our website and on our SoundCloud page, which we will link to in the show notes, Emily and I actually did talk about those quite a bit. And so I think Michael and I just didn't want to be redundant, but it certainly is. The toe socks ads certainly are related to the pornification of yoga. And that's definitely a direction that we could have gone in. Perhaps we'll address that a little bit more in the future. I do remember that Catherine Buttigieg article that you're talking about, and I think Emily and I even addressed that in the first podcast too. I remember when she talks about how her body in her 20s was different than her body in her 30s. And as someone who at the time was just getting ready to turn 30, I was like, you know, I resonate with that. That makes a lot of sense to me. And I know we had a lot to say on that podcast, so please go check it out. And again, I think that that's a great topic to address more in the future. And Michael, I want to let you address the point that was directed to you, or should I call you a gentleman, Michael?
Yeah. Yes. 4 words. Don't get me started. No, just kidding. I have a lot of opinions about the quote-unquote pornification of yoga, but they're really kind of in a bigger ocean of our culture and the opportunities that exist in our culture for transformation. And one of the sort of things that we suffer from in our culture is a sort of a distraction. And pornification is, to me, sort of a kind of a distraction, because, you know, we're all going to die, Kat, as you and I were talking about yesterday.
That's Michael's favorite topic,
lately.
Listeners.
And, you know, as I understand it, meditation and some of these deeper practices of yoga are sort of charnel ground work, or as I've been taught, actually, by some of my beloved teachers, they're preparations for dying, in a sense. And I don't want to be like a whole, you know, bum, bum,
bum. Don't be a Debbie Downer.
I don't want to be a Debbie Downer, but it's like it's also a form of celebration, because it's like, oh, I've figured out what's going on. So I don't want to distract myself from what I'm trying to do. And I hope this isn't going to come off to the listeners being kind of Debbie Downer, as Kat just said a minute ago. But it's like, I don't really want to look at, like, you know, really attractive folks in toe socks. I don't want that to be my reason for being enticed into a yoga class.
I think, to be fair, that might come back to what the letter was saying, that, you know, that's maybe not what's going to attract you, but that might be what would attract someone else to a class, and whether that's problematic or not,
you know,
a whole other discussion.
I don't know. Because what my point is, and where I'm going with that, is that that looks a little distracting. It's like, if sex is going to be what entices me into a yoga class, I maybe need to look a little bit at what my intentions are. That's my personal belief.
Sure.
And here's the thing. Those toe sock ads, I love them. I mean, I think they're beautiful.
Oh, the photography, the Jasper.
The photography is great. And
yeah,
like Catherine Buttick's body is like fabulous, and the curves of it and the way the light shines off of, you know, like her body and stuff. It's beautiful. It's art. And as I love to look at really great art, I let my art be my art and I let my yoga be my yoga. And then I let the two play occasionally, but I try to be as clear as I can about what my intentions are for doing what it is that I'm doing. And that's all I'm trying to say. So I don't really like seeing a lot of, like, overly sexualized images in yoga culture, because I think it kind of distracts from what is precious, holy, dharmic teaching. But at the same time, that's just me, and I kind of, like, let people get into it for what they want to get into it for. So anyway, that's sort of my opinion.
Look for our upcoming podcast on toe socks ads, everyone.
Yeah.
It sounds like. Yeah. Well, thank you, Michael, for offering your perspective. Thank you, listeners, for writing in, Faith and Brantley. And again, yogatalk@yogainternational.com if you have anything to say to us. And thank you, Sherry, so much for coming in and sharing your experience and your wisdom. Don't forget to check out the show notes for more information about Sherry's upcoming training. We are going to take you out with The Householders and Namaste Nation.
Namaste.